Yeah, thanks again. So I should say that this is not a talk about some recent technical work, but supposed to present, I mean, from my own point of view, a general consistent picture on time in quantum gravity, and also, of course, should present issues for the discussion of that conference. So let me start here with actually the title of the conference, Quantizing Time, or Quantizing Time, question mark. So to quantize is a verb, and it suggests to turn classical time into an operator, t hat. Certainly easy to do with LaTeX, for example, but is it also possible mathematically? Does this make sense? Now, yesterday's talk by Flavio Marcati, we already had this theme, and it goes back to Pauli. And let me quote Pauli from his famous book, one of my favorite textbooks on quantum mechanics, where he writes, we thus conclude that one must completely go without the introduction of an operator T, and that the time T in wave mechanics must necessarily be considered as an ordinary number or C number. Now, and Tiklo concludes this from the fact that it's in contradiction with the boundedness of energy. Now, Unruh and Wald, in their paper of 1989, they explicitly say that they present a strengthening of Pauli's theory. And they write, in ordinary Schrodinger quantum mechanics for a system with a Hamiltonian bounded from below, no dynamical variable can correlate monotonically with the Schrodinger time t. And that's the role of time in the interpretation of Schrodinger quantum mechanics cannot be replaced by that of a dynamical variable. So it seems that this is not possible. Of course, you can do things like the Kappa-Minkowski time of Mercalli from yesterday. That's certainly possible, but that's not really making t a self-adjoint operator. So my talk is here divided up into three short parts, time in quantum mechanics, time in quantum cosmology, and the last part on the emergence of time, where emergence will become clear what it means later. Okay, time in quantum mechanics. Now, of course, we have the time-dependent Schrodinger equation that we all know, I h bar d psi over dt is h operator psi. This can be, justified in various ways. And one nice way is perhaps that from the classical constraint, pt plus h in the Dirac sense of weak equality is equal to zero. Now you get that equation, and this was known long ago. If you parameterize mechanics, if you elevate the time t to a dynamical variable q naught, and then you get a constraint actually, and this pt plus h equal to zero. And if you formally quantize that pt by h bar over I d over dt, then you get a Schrodinger equation. So you might perhaps ask the question, what is more fundamental, this time-dependent Schrodinger equation or a time-independent Schrodinger equation like h psi is equal to e psi? Now I learned as a student that the time-dependent one is much more fundamental, and that the time-independent one comes from particular cases like stationary situations of the hydrogen atom and so on. And I certainly believed this for a long time. Maybe until I discovered Mott's paper of 1931, where he, in a very exciting way, actually recovers the time-dependent Schrodinger equation from the time-independent one. So taking the time-independent one as a more fundamental description, because it's not so clear what the T fundamentally is. It's not an operator according to Pauli. So perhaps one should reformulate quantum mechanics such that the time-dependent Schrodinger equation is an effective one. Now Mott, in his paper, he writes, we shall confine ourselves to the somewhat idealized case of the collision between an alpha particle and an atom consisting of a single electron bound in the field of an infinitely heavy nucleus. We have to show that the same probabilities of excitation result whether we consider the problem as a one-body problem or as a two-body problem. What he means by that is that a two-body problem, he writes down the stationary Schrodinger equation. Actually, he writes it down even in the form h psi equals zero, remembering, the constraint equations of quantum gravity, putting the e to the left-hand side. So the two-body problem is the alpha particle and the atom. The one quadratic problem is just a standard treatment of time-dependent Schrödinger equation. But the interesting one is that he recovers from that time-independent one, the time-dependent one, by making this ansatz. So the total psi satisfying h psi equals zero is a function f of small r and capital R times e to the I k z. Now, the small r is the position of the electron in the atom, hydrogen type atom, and the capital R with components x, y, z is the position of the alpha particle. And so e to the I k z, of course, you see the alpha particle is in the state of a plane wave. Now, by making this ansatz, Mott derives the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and the T actually is related directly to the z. From the more fundamental time-independent Schrödinger equation, and he refers explicitly to the Born-Oppenheimer approximation that was at that time rather newer, from 1927, where you can treat nuclei plus electron system conveniently by having the nuclei masses much heavier than the electron masses, and actually having the motion of the electrons or the dynamics of the electrons in the field of the nuclei. And here, actually, it's the alpha particle, and the alpha particle defines the time, right? So you have a closed system, stationary, with two subsystems, and one subsystem defines the time with respect to the other. So it seems that this paper was not followed up really very much later, but we will see that in quantum gravity, we actually have a similar situation. Now, approaching the theme of time in quantum gravity, of course, the whole conference is devoted to various approaches. John Wheeler once wrote, "No question about quantum gravity is more difficult than the question, what is the question, or what is the correct approach? Perhaps we have a partial answer after the conference." Now, there are many approaches, and the most conservative approach is certainly quantum general relativity. So taking Einstein's classical theory of general relativity as a starting point and applying quantization rules. And you can methodologically divide up to covariant approaches or canonical approaches. The covariant approaches, I think these days, is mainly on path integrals. Historically, it was perturbation theory with Feynman diagrams, spin foams, asymptotic safety, or the canonical approaches, so geometric dynamics, connection dynamics, loop dynamics. Drastically different, of course, is string theory, which is where gravity is treated as an emergent interaction. You start with a fundamental quantum theory of all interactions with no gravity and other interactions, and then in a certain process, you recover what we call the gravitational field. So, of course, to discuss time in quantum gravity, and in view of my limited time here and a strict chairwoman, I think I will only deal one approach, and this is quantum general relativity and the canonical approach, the Hamiltonian approach, independent of the question whether this is the correct fundamental approach or not. It's suitable as a given approach to discuss the issues. I cannot derive it here, but I want to motivate it for those of you who are perhaps not fully familiar with it. How do you find canonical quantum geometric dynamics? It is obtained if one follows the path that was followed by Erwin Schrödinger when deriving or guessing his wave equation in 1926. What he did at that time is, okay, look for a wave equation, because Louis de Broglie emphasized the wave nature of everything, also of electrons. So a wave equation was needed. And Schrödinger was very competent in Hamilton-Jacobi methods and in geometric and wave optics. And he rewrote classical mechanics in Hamilton-Jacobi form. And then he guessed a wave equation that gives back the Hamilton-Jacobi equation in what we today call the WKB limit, or what he called the Iconal limit, like the limit wave optics to geometric optics. Let me quote from his paper here in the English translation. So we know today, in fact, that our classical mechanics fails for very small dimensions of the path and for very great curvatures. Perhaps this failure is in strict analogy with the failure of geometrical optics that becomes evident as soon as the obstacles or apertures are no longer great compared with the real finite wavelengths. Then it becomes a question of searching for an undulatory mechanics, and the most obvious way is by elaboration of the Hamiltonian analogy on the lines of undulatory optics. So the question is, if we follow this strategy for Einstein equations, what do we get? So rewriting Einstein equations in Hamilton-Jacobi form, this was done long ago by Asher-Peres in 1962, and then guessing a wave equation that gives back Einstein equations in the semi-classical limit. This one can do, and the result is what we call the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, if we use metric variables. Here is John Wheeler, and I do not, of course, give technical details, but actually, if we apply Schrödinger's procedure to general relativity, this is what Arnovit, Deza, Miesner, and others did, you get these four local equations. H orthogonal on psi is equal to zero, and HA on psi is equal to zero. Now, the latter is called the quantum diffeomorphism momentum constraint. It was already discussed before the Wheeler-DeWitt equation by Peter Higgs, I mean the Higgs from the Higgs particle, end of the 50s, who also gave the meaning of that. And he showed that this just means that the psi is independent on the coordinates that you choose on the three-dimensional surface. And it's a three-dimensional geometry only. So HAB, what we have here is the three-dimensional metric, not a four-dimensional one. So this is the covariant derivative on the three-dimensional geometry. This is the matter part. H is the determinant of the three metric, and this is the current of matter, say, the pointing vector in electrodynamics, for example. Now here, G is the gravitational constant. This is called the DeWitt metric, and it's you can spell it out. It depends without derivatives on the three metric. So this is a second formal functional derivative. And this is the kinetic term, and this is the potential term, and this is the matter contribution, the three-dimensional Ricci scalar cosmological constant. Now, the essential message from this is, of course, that psi depends only on the three geometry. You know? So as John Wheeler often wrote in his essays, that the three-dimensional geometry is the carrier of dynamics. And yes, explained that here at the blackboard. It was very good at blackboard talks. I can remember only to have attended one of them. So you have here mechanics, and you have here a trajectory of a particle going from A to B. And in addition, the external Newtonian time. Then if you go to quantum mechanics, the trajectory disappears. We know there's no, at least no classical trajectory. Maybe in Bohm theory you have another tie, but we have no classical trajectory. So you just have space, psi of q's, but in addition you have the Newtonian t. Now in relativity, the analog of this whole trajectory is space-time, you know, as a succession of three geometries. And if you quantize in the traditional Schrödinger way, then space-time dissolves and only space remains. And you have a psi of a three geometry, but you have no additional t, because the general relativity has no absolute time separate from space-time. Everything is in space-time. So the T has disappeared. Now, this is often called the problem of time. I'm not sure whether it's really a problem. It's the issue of time. And it's clear where it comes from. I distinguish here between a classical version and a quantum version. The classical version, I would say, is the absence of non-dynamical space-time, or what we call background independence. So everything is dynamical. There's a lack of the external time. Actually, this was already spelled out clearly by Pauli in the proceedings of the Bern Conference of 55, where he says that's the main obstacle to quantizing gravity, background independence. Einstein very early had written here in the translation, it is contrary to the scientific mode of understanding to postulate a thing that acts, but which cannot be acted upon. I mean, the space-time of special relativity with Minkowski metric is just an arena that does not act, that is not acted upon, only acts. And in general relativity, as we all know, we have background independence. Now, as the quantum version, I would consider the absence of space-time in the sense here of John Wheeler, which corresponds to the absence of classical trajectory in quantum mechanics. So only the three geometry remains. Now, if you look carefully into the structure of this equation done long ago, especially in de Witt's pioneering paper of 67, where he discusses in great detail the properties of the de Witt metric, it turns out that this part actually has an indefinite signature, a hyperbolic structure of a wave equation, minus, plus, 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 and so on. So it's not just as in the Schrödinger equation, just considers here of minuses. It's more of a D'Alembertian nature. So this thing has a different, this kinetic term, a different structure. And there's one, in fact, one local degree of freedom that has a different sign. And this one local degree of freedom, you can baptize an intrinsic time. It's constructed from space, but it's distinguished by here the kinetic term. So this is what I mean here. The locally hyperbolic nature of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation may allow the introduction of an intrinsic time, or as Julian Barber says, the ephemeris time, because ephemeris time is the concept of time used by astronomers long ago, I mean, before the advent of atomic time, because it's the time that you get by from actual observation of spatial positions of planets. So actually from spatial properties. It's not out there this time, it's constructed. An open question, and it may be one of the things to discuss at the conference, is in this context, what happens to probability interpretation? Because probability interpretation, I again refer to Pauli's book and his papers, because he emphasized that we need Hilbert space in quantum mechanics because of the probability interpretation, especially because of the conservation of probability in time, that is because of unitarity. So you have the conservation of probability in time t, which is in Newtonian time t. And but what happens if the Newtonian time has disappeared? So a possible answer of this, and I leave it like that here, is in the context of relational observables and conditional probabilities. So for example, my student Leonardo Chatenier has written this recent paper, and he will give a talk on Friday, I think the first talk on Friday, with more technical issues on that, how probabilities can be understood in the timeless context. Now in quantum cosmology, and that's the, at least the framework where the mathematics does not present obstacles. I mean, the full formalism, as we all know, has still not fully understood. So in quantum cosmology here, I consider for definiteness a closed Friedmann-Lemaître universe with a scale factor A containing a homogeneous massive scalar field phi. So a two-dimensional mini superspace, so two homogeneous degrees of freedom. Classically, the four-dimensional line element is that minus n squared dt squared. N is the Laplace function because you can redefine t to any function of t. Actually, this is what appears already in the parameterized particle, which leads to pt plus h equal to zero that I presented earlier. And we have here this spatial part, the scale factor squared, and the line element on the three sphere. Now the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in appropriate units is written down here. So you have h psi is equal to zero. The psi depends on a and phi. So there's no t, there's no a of t, no phi of t. It's just the psi of a and phi, the kinetic term, the potential term. And you see here explicitly the kinetic term, the hyperbolic structure. Now you have here the minus, which you would also expect from the Schrödinger equation with the field, but the sign with respect to A is positive. And this is generally true in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. The degree of freedom with the different sign is the local volume of three geometry. And here we have just a global one, also the scale factor because of homogeneity. Of course, if you have more degrees of freedom, then it becomes clear that here you have the plus, because here in two dimensions, you can multiply by minus one. But if you have here, say, a Kantorsky-Sachs universe, then the other degrees of freedom come with a minus. Okay, I have, of course, chosen a suitable factor ordering, and I don't enter the factor ordering issue here. This brings me to one important central conceptual issue about time in quantum gravity based on that wave equation and that structure. And this is a different meaning of determinism and classical and quantum theory. So the classical theory here, let us consider this two-dimensional mini superspace and a universe model that expands, has a maximum and recollapse. And independent of now the observational situation, there's an eternally expanding universe. So the point is we have here a trajectory in this configuration space. So we could give here initial conditions, calculate a trajectory, and we can see that this recollapsing part is certainly the deterministic successor of the expanding part. Now the arrow is arbitrary, you could start here. There's not yet any direction of the parameterization. So the arrow of time issue has not been settled here. It's just a trajectory. But what about a quantum theory? Now, I just told you we have only a wave equation in a phi space. There's no t. So there's also no trajectory. So if you want to construct a wave packet, as we often do in quantum optics, that is concentrated along that, what do you have to do? I mean, you have to impose boundary conditions suitable for a hyperbolic equation. And for a hyperbolic equation means that for that variable, the intrinsic time, you choose the wave function and its derivative at A equals constant. So that is, you must here pose a wave packet and here pose a wave packet, and then you solve the equation. So the initial conditions are put here on all of A equals constant. So this means that what here would be Big Bang and the Big Crunch, or Big Bang here and Big Crunch here, would be here not distinguishable. And here are the initial conditions. And in this sense, the classically recollapsing wave packet must be present initially with respect to the initial value formulation of the hyperbolic equation. So there's no intrinsic difference between Big Bang and Big Crunch. And if you say, well, I just do as I did in Schrödinger quantum mechanics, have a wave packet here and try to follow it here. Well, if you just have one packet here and you solve the relativity equation, you just get a smeared out solution. You will not recognize that. So that's a very important difference between classical and quantum, has to do with the absence of trajectories in the quantum. This is an old example. I mean, you can do many examples. H pi equals zero here with in suitable units with a scale factor and a field. It's a redefined field. It comes from coupling a conformally coupled field to a Friedmann-Lemaître universe. And classically, the solutions are Lissajous ellipses in configuration space. And quantum mechanically, if you want to construct the wave packets that follow this, you really have to here at A equals constant put the initial condition of having the two packets. So only if you do that can you have here a wave packet that corresponds to an expansion and recollapse, and expansion here and recollapse. Actually, it's here a superposition of two. Now, otherwise, you get a smeared out, maybe also with exponentially increasing solution. Now, so that's very important. So for the initial value problem, and this is related to time. Okay, so here, this is just a picture in this conference article with my former student, Branislav Nikolic, that things are discussed. So the absence of time in full quantum gravity is just depicted here. Now, what do we mean? What do we make out of this? We have a timeless situation, it seems, a static world, but this is not what we observe apparently. So the issue is, of course, to understand, I mean, how at least approximately the standard time in relativity or for quantum field theory in curved space time emerges. This is sketched here. This is, of course, not something new, but I emphasize this here because it will relate with the old Mott's paper on the Schrödinger equation. I think Lapchinsky and Rubakov first did it, but also other people, including myself. worked on various aspects. So what is done here is a von Oppenheimer type. It's not exactly von Oppenheimer approximation scheme. You can do it in various ways. Most straightforward is to expand with respect to the Planck mass squared, mp squared is h bar over g. So you write the full state, which is a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, depending on the three metric and matter field, could also be an electromagnetic field, as an e to the I over h bar s, where s can be complex. And you expand s in powers of mp to the mp squared. Then you have mp squared s naught plus s1 plus mp to the minus 2 s2 and so on. So we insert this into the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and we compare different orders of mp squared. So in a sense, this is what we do. And it's not so far also from what Schrödinger did in the 20s. The highest order tells you that s naught, the first term is independent of the matter contribution, only depends on gravity. And the next order tells you that this s naught depending only on gravity obeys the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And then we are back at a classical formulation, the Hamilton-Jacobi version of Einstein's field equation. Now the next order is a little bit more complicated. There's an equation for S1 that you first must rewrite to get inside. So that we define the small f as a function that depends only on the three geometry times e to the I S1, and we demand a certain equation for the WKB prefactor, or that is the DB, the standard WKB prefactor equation. And then we can introduce a local time, a bubble time or Tomonaga-Schwinger time from this highest order S naught, just a directional derivative in configuration space, but with the DeWitt metric. So this is indefinite. So it has a space-like, light-like and time-like directions in configuration space. But this is in really an analogy with what Mott did for the alpha particle in 1931. So there, remember the alpha particle gave the standard of time for the atom. And here it's a three geometry that gives the standard of time for the matter fields. And this way you recover quantum field theory in curved space time. So that's our picture from that conference, the emergence of semi-classical time here. That's again written here. So IH bar df over d tau is the matter Hamiltonian density on f. Well, this is a local equation. It's not yet a Schrödinger equation because this taus and depends on x. And this is why also the tau is actually not the scalar function, which you can immediately see by making here the commutator on the left-hand side is tau on different space points. And here you have a commutator with the hm at different space points, which is non-vanishing. And so d over d tau does not commute with itself at different points. So it's not a scalar function, in spite of the name, for good reasons. But you can integrate it, choosing a particular value for the lapse in the shift function to yield a full Schrödinger, a functional Schrödinger equation, describing the limit of quantum fields in curved space-time. Now, the next order is, of course, interesting because this brings in really quantum gravity corrections, where perhaps at some time in the future you can connect an observational test with it. I mean, we have tried, but so far these terms are small. Yeah, the next order in the von Oppenheimer approximation gives the corrected Schrödinger equation with the hm added, supplemented by 1 over Planck mass squared, and many terms that I did not write down here. So we did that long ago with Singh, and with Bauminsky gave a covariant description in terms of Feynman diagrams. But more recently, of course, the interest arose whether in here the power spectrum gets here calculable corrections. And yes, it does. It's not so easy, it turns out, as you can see, that there are various papers. But given certain assumptions and maybe a certain way that perhaps also Leonardo and Friedrich mentions, you get a definite expression for that corrected power spectrum. So independent of its size, you get from this approach concrete numbers. There's no issue with regularization because the terms are small, but because of this, so far, unobservably small. I do not enter this because I have no time in that talk. So with Branislav, we also discuss Weyl gravity, for example, as an alternative to Einstein gravity and Weyl gravity plus Einstein gravity. Of course, Weyl gravity is conformally invariant. If you do there the semi-classical approximation, you have a scaleless time, which is very interesting, but this is only a side remark. Now, approaching the end, maybe of the talk, what happens to quantum superposition? I mean, yesterday in Czeslaw Bruckner's talk, we heard about superposition of masses, which of course you would expect to be relevant in quantum gravity. It corresponds to superposition of, say, gravitational fields. Also here in quantum cosmology, because all these formalisms that I mentioned, they are linear. And this means that arbitrary superpositions of the gravitational field and matter states can occur. So how can we understand the emergence of the observed approximate classical universe? And the answer, at least the only answer I can really understand in this context, is decoherence. And I will not give a talk on decoherence here, just mentioning that in quantum mechanics, this is by now well established, also experimentally. And again, the issue is you have a closed system, a fully quantum closed system. You need to divide it up in two parts. Now remember from what this division led to the emergence of the time. One gives time for the other. Also, for example, if you think about Berry phase, also this comes from dividing up the total system into two systems, small systems. Otherwise, you would not have the notion of a Berry phase. And if you have h psi equals zero for the full universe, then there is no time and no classicality. So you must distinguish what are the two parts, what is your system, what is your environment. And long ago, Tse suggested that the system be the global degrees of freedom, such as a scale factor, and the environment are small variables, typically not directly observable, like the density fluctuation or gravitational waves. And I did the first calculations on these questions in 87. And later, with Russian colleagues, we more carefully invented some regularization methods, because you have to, with all these degrees of freedom, there are infinitely many, so you have to sum them up and you have to get something finite. This is, for example, here one example. So you have a scale factor of the Sitter universe, and this is a system, semi-classically, of course, experienced decoherence by gravitons, and the reduced density matrix is modified by such a Gaussian factor, which means that the non-diagonal terms, which give interferences between A and A prime, they are suppressed, and they are the more suppressed, the bigger A is. So the bigger the three geometry is, the more are these suppressed, and the more classical does the universe appear. So in fact, we have shown here with Barwinski and Kamenschek that the universe assumes classical properties at the beginning of inflation. In other words, if you look back towards the inflationary area, you see our classical universe, but towards the beginning of inflation, you have destructive interference with other components of the wave function. And so in a sense, classicality ends. You can also superpose different semi-classical components like this e to the I s naught that I used earlier to derive the Schrodinger equation and the complex conjugate, because in a sense, it's perhaps cheated to have here only this particular solution with the I, and we have a real equation, a real Dividi equation has no I, it's not a Schrodinger equation. So you might wish to have a cosine, for example. The cosine is what you get typically from the Hubble-Hawking proposal. But this would not give you a classical world. No? You would not find a Schrodinger equation. And so you have to think about whether they also decohere. And in fact, they do. And this is an analogy with something very well understood in quantum mechanics, namely the origin of chirality, say of optical activity, where you have here also a parity invariant Hamiltonian, but you observe molecules that have a certain structure that break chirality. And this is done through decoherence by scattering with light and air molecules. So I had once made just a toy model here for the quantum cosmology case that for today's universe, say this decoherence factor is so small that you certainly do not have to worry about the quantum effects, only when you really go back to the early universe. Error of time was briefly mentioned. It's also not, I have not included the derivation of this. I would only point a possible route towards understanding the origin of irreversibility from quantum gravity, because I mean, what usually is the problem is that our equations are invariant under time reversal. I mean, this is small, of course, violations that were discussed in one of the previous talks, but that we observe this irreversibility. Here in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, for the first time, we have something asymmetric in the equation itself, and it's in this intrinsic time, alpha. Alpha is the logarithm of the scale factor, just for simplicity, because here that potential vanishes if you approach a to zero, alpha to minus infinity. It becomes very complicated when you increase a. So if you solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and you start with a state that for small a is such a product state, then it will necessarily become entangled because here of that potential. So if you define an entanglement entropy for alpha by integrating out xi, then this entropy will increase because entanglement increases. And but this has not, I think, fully been calculated so far, but at least from the idea, this should be the way how you should proceed. So in the semi-classical limit, this should give them the direction of the semi-classical time, which so far had no direction. So perhaps the expansion of the universe is only a tautology. We have long ago investigated the error of time in a recollapsing quantum universe. So you all know Penrose's picture of the Weyl tensor hypothesis, where you have a smooth Big Bang and an inhomogeneous Big Crunch. Here the Weyl tensor is zero, and then of course structure forms. You have black holes like stalactites. And so Big Bang is very special, and Penrose had the idea that, of course, a fundamental theory should explain this. It's not that I can or we can explain this, but if you go to quantum cosmology, then, as I said, this is small a and this is small a. So this is in the argument of the wave function. It's not a different region. So if you have a structure for the Big Bang, it should also be called for the Big Crunch because this is small a. So actually you get a time symmetric picture here. The radius zero, radius zero, and you would have an expanding universe from here to here, but also from here to here. Entropy would also increase from here to here. And there's no paradox because at the maximal extension, the classical approximation breaks down and you have destructive interference. Now, this is the last slide, actually. I hope I have not used too much time. We're also asked, I mean, the speakers to give two questions that they find of interest, maybe for the general discussion. And they are written down here. So the first is, does the probability interpretation of quantum theory make sense at the most fundamental level of quantum gravity? And what I mean is that when you do the semi-classical approximation, you recover the structure of the Schrödinger equation and so on. And of course, this brings with it naturally the whole machinery of Hilbert spaces and so on. But does this probability interpretation also hold in a situation where the semi-classical approximation breaks down? Question mark. Now, Price-DeWitt once wrote that in fact, time and probability are only phenomenological concepts that have no place at the fundamental level. And from my discussions with David long ago, I also remember that he had this attitude. So the question is, that does this interpretation hold? And connected, I mean, these two are connected. Is there a sensible notion of time beyond the semi-classical level? Okay, with this, I leave it. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. We are slightly over time, so does anyone have a really short question? Siddhant, you want to ask a short question?
Yeah, I had a very quick question. So I really didn't understand the remark about the emergence of time with the comment about Mott and the alpha decay, because I remember in Mott's paper, he really had a time-independent analysis with the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So maybe I missed something.
I mean, oops, no. Okay, I'm not sure whether I fully understand, so I just maybe say this in new words again, what he does in that paper. I mean, he has this two-body problem with the alpha particle and the atom, and he writes down for it a stationary Schrödinger equation. H psi is equal to E psi, the E he puts to the left-hand side, so that he has an effective H psi equals zero equation. And then he makes this von Oppenheimer type of approximation with this ansatz and neglects certain terms, which he has two masses, and I mean the atom is heavier. And then he has a term of the form I d over dz and another function. And this just appears at a position that you can call it then the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Now that's what he did in that paper. He gave also this other way of treatment with more standard treatment, but the interesting thing for us is that two-body problem. So he has from the stationary equation, this ansatz, and this I gives them the I in the Schrödinger equation, and this corresponds to our I M Planck squared S naught later. No? This is the I M Planck squared S naught. And then you have this D over DA, I mean D chi over DH, D over DH. And then something similar happens here for the alpha particles. I'm not sure whether I was now clearer or.
No, I still don't get the analogy, but thanks for the response. I will take a look.
I'm happy to discuss this further. No, I mean, that's here what you get in semi-classical quantum gravity, and this d over dt in Mott's work, you would have here the d over dz and here d phase over dz term. Yeah. That directional derivative, now you have a directional derivative at the semi-classical level because you have the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So you have, like in geometric optics, now you have the light rays, and along this you can define this directional derivative, and so either you have the z or you have the Feynman. That's the analogy, but please contact me and I'll try to be clearer.
Thanks for your response.